Maybe I'll do a little bit of a sound check. Is the volume okay? Does it seem like it's... Can I get an okay sign? Yes, it needs to be louder. I don't know if maybe if you can help it or if I... There we go. Oh, wait. Yikes. Is this okay? Is this a little bit louder? Is this going to be okay? Maybe I need to move this microphone even closer. How is this? Is this any better? Yeah, I think it's a little bit better. Okay. So just recently I was poking around in the suttas. I was looking at how is it? Well, like what happens when the Buddha gives instructions to people and they become awakened? What is the setting in which this happens? And so there's this setting that occurs with a number of different people, and the description is exactly the same. And it goes like this. When the Blessed One knew that this person's heart was ready, receptive, free from the hindrances, elated and confident, he gave them the teachings that are special to the Buddhas. Suffering, the origin, cessation, and the path leading to the cessation. But this caught my eye. I had read this many times before. Ready, receptive, free of the hindrances, elated. Like, often we don't hear this word, right? Elated. When we think about people's minds and that are been practicing and about to become awakened. So I looked this word up in Pali. It's udaga, which in English doesn't quite sound so inspiring, but in English we might translate it literally as out and top. So going up and out, so elated. But I was thinking that maybe a better way would be uplifted. To have a heart that's uplifted. Many of you know that in Pali this word citta can be translated as both mind and heart. So to have a heart and mind that's uplifted. What does that mean? How might we explore that or practice with that idea? And one thing that came to mind is the last week when there was a little bit of snow in the morning. When I looked out the window, like, oh, look. So there's that little bit of this kind of like uplift. And the other day, I was sitting in with Rebecca, and there was this bird just outside the window that was making this really fantastic sound that wasn't familiar to me. Again, there was that kind of like this uplift, or maybe hearing the coyotes in the evening. So this experience of this maybe touching something that resonates inside of us. Maybe in the same way that sometimes I know here on retreat and at IMS, you know, to watch the sunset, watch the sunrise. And it had a big impact on me on one of the three-month retreats I sat here, that sleeping in my room, minding my own business, and feeling like, what is going on? Like, what is the neighbor doing that's keeping me awake? Like, what are they doing? And then finally, when I kind of woke up, I realized it wasn't the neighbor. It was the moon. It was so bright coming into my room. And I was like, wow, kind of this uplift again. And then you can imagine the next time I came and sat a 3-month retreat, I put on my little calendar, okay, here's when all the full moons are, and make sure that you're awake and pay attention. It didn't have quite the same effect, right? But so this idea of uplift. And maybe I'll also say that last week I chuckled when Bhante said, Buddhism doesn't have a god, it has lists. And it's true, right? There's lots of lists. And some of you who are familiar with the suttas even know that there are lists of lists. So this very kind of formulaic, 1, 2, 3, 4. But there's also a lot of poetry. There's a lot of verse. So it's this combination of things that are very directed and maybe it's a sense of do one thing after the other. And then there's also this poetry. Sometimes when it gets translated into English, doesn't have the same beauty as it does in Pali. But I'd like to think that that's also kind of pointing to this uplift in the heart. And I think in our lives, we need both. We need lists and we need poetry. There was a time when I was a research scientist. I'm trained as a scientist. And I was doing cancer research at a cancer center. And all of us crazy scientists, they kept in the basement. These laboratories, right, with no windows, and you know, the upper floors would be the patients and the doctors, and there was this kind of, you know, it was a little bit dungeon feeling down there in the basement, these laboratories, and there was a really strong pressure to just work a lot, just put in a lot of hours. And for the most part, we were happy to do this because we felt inspired that we were working to like cure cancer and to help some of these patients. And it was, you know, a really meaningful work. But this was in Washington, D.C., and I would find myself slipping out of the laboratory and going to the art museums. I remember specifically, some of you may know, in Washington, D.C., there's this Hirshhorn sculpture garden that has more, you know, 20th century art. Some of it is representational. You can tell what it is. It's a figure or something. And some of it is abstract. And I would find myself touched by this. It'd be this resonance inside or this uplift. And my friends would be asking me, Diana, what are you doing? And why are you going to art museums of all places? And I couldn't explain it. It was like there was this different language, maybe, that gets spoken. That's different than the scientific or mathematical or, you know, very directional. So back then there was this recognition that, at least I do, and I think the Buddha knew this too, we need both these lists and this poetry. In fact, in the suttas, there is a poet who is well known for his poetry, and the Buddha encourages him. And maybe I'll read a little bit about this. So the setting is, the Buddha is teaching, the sutta says, 1,250 monastics. A lot, right? I'm sure they didn't count them, but this is a big number. And this And this is in ancient India, of course. And back then, pavement hadn't been invented, right? So everything is with dirt. So everything gets a little bit dirty or dusty. And in the summer, it's really hot. So this poet, who was a monastic, his name was Vangisa. So the sutta goes like this. On that occasion, the Blessed One was instructing, inspiring, and gladdening the monastic. So here we go again, right? This idea of like taking care of our hearts. The Blessed One was instructing, inspiring, and gladdening the monastics with a talk on Nibbana. The monastics were paying attention, engaging wholeheartedly, lending an ear. Then the Venerable Vangisa rose from his seat, arranged his robe over his shoulder, raised his hands in reverential salutation to the Buddha, and said, "An inspiration has come to me, O Blessed One. An inspiration has come to me, O Fortunate One." And then the Buddha replied, "Then speak as you feel inspired." And then Vangisa says some verses, and I've shortened this. Vangisa praised the Buddha, and he said, "Over 1,000 monastics revere the Holy One as he teaches the dust-free Dharma and Nibbana, freedom from fear. They listen to the dust-free Dharma taught by the fully awakened Buddha." And he turns to the Buddha and says, "You are like a great cloud that rains on your disciples." If we think of hot, dusty India, a cloud of rain is something that's welcome. It's a relief. Washes over you. And one thing that's really great about rain is, right, it's indiscriminate. It goes and it lands on everybody. So then the sutta continues. The Buddha says to Vangisa in response to this, "Vangisa, had you previously composed those verses or did they occur to you spontaneously?" "Venerable Sir, I had not previously composed these verses. They occurred to me spontaneously." "In that case, Vangisa, speak some more spontaneously inspired verses." And then the sutta continues with some more verses from Vangisa. So we see here that, you know, the Buddha's encouraging this inspiration and this poetry of some sort. So there is a way in which I can use this word beauty that uplifts the heart and mind. And beauty here is, I'm not talking about like pleasant visual experiences. We often use the word beauty for that. But instead, I'm pointing to something that uplifts and resonates in the heart, in the mind. Something that touches us, moves us. And we are not denying, we are not repressing all the things that are difficult and that we desperately wish would go away. I'm not saying that that's also not part of our experience. But sometimes we can forget, or we feel like maybe dismiss some of those things that our hearts resonate with. Sometimes we can think that that's not so important. I have to get rid of this terrible thing. Maybe not recognizing or appreciating the importance of having a mind and a heart that's ready, receptive, free of the hindrances, elated and confident. So a number of years ago, Gil Fronstahl, Max Ertstein, and I were teaching a year-long course at the Insight Meditation Center called Deepening Meditation. And right before we were about ready to start teaching this course, Gil had been poking around in the suttas, as he does, and he had this new idea about beauty, about seeing the beauty in the practice. And he pointed out that there is this expression that's only in the suttas. It's not very common, but it is in there, this idea of someone who is proficient in meditation as being skilled in the beauty of meditation. What would it be like to discover, align with, attune to the beauty of meditation? What would it be like to sit with beauty, sit in beauty? An advantage of using this type of language, as opposed to something like settledness or attentive or clarity or concentrated or something like this, is that often when we think about concentration or settledness or mindfulness, sometimes we say, well, I was concentrated. This is my concentration, my mindfulness. But there's something about kind of like aligning with, attuning to the beauty of meditation, where there isn't such a sense of self, of mine and me. It's just the beauty of meditation. And Gil, Max, and I, we discovered that when we kind of like kicked off this deepening meditation, this year-long program, and we kicked it off with this idea of beauty and meditation, it had a big impact on people. Kind of a different way to think about practice, a different way to approach practice. Again, without denying the difficulties and the ugly, if I could say that, the non-beautiful, without repressing that, without pretending that that's not there, but also just allowing the beautiful. And there is very often in the suttas, quite a few times, this expression, the Dharma is beautiful in the beginning. The Dharma is beautiful in the middle. The Dharma is beautiful in the end. So maybe we can think about this as Dharma beauty, this beauty of meditation. So the word in Pali that's getting translated as beautiful here is the word kalyana. Some of you may be familiar with this word because sometimes we have this expression kalyanamitta, a good spiritual friend. And so kalyana sometimes is translated as the word good. And that's good. But this word is actually sprinkled throughout the suttas. And if you look both at the Pali dictionaries and the Sanskrit dictionaries, they actually talk more about beauty than they do about good. It's just that our modern translators had chosen this word. But when you start thinking about beauty, it's different than good. Good can have this moralistic tone to it. Whereas beauty maybe it's something that we all have our own sense of what's beautiful for us, what resonates with us, what moves us, what touches us. And so maybe we can ask if this idea of the Dharma is beautiful in the beginning, the middle, and the end. We can ask, well, what is the beauty the Buddha is pointing to? Can we participate in that beauty, or can we align ourselves with that beauty? Can we live in that beauty? Living with the Dharma. So there's a way in which we can practice with a lot of specificity of directions, step one, step two, step three, or with a lot of lists. And, right, I'm the one that's trained as a scientist. I love these lists. I really do. Don't get me wrong. But I also want to encourage us that, you know, to think a little bit, there's another way to practice, or an additional way to practice, or maybe to do with the steps and this very intentionality and directionality. Can we also do it with some space, spaciousness in our hearts? Maybe in a softer way, and in a way that we're feeling and sensing our way with the Dharma, as opposed to following the instructions and checking them off. Or can we follow the instructions and check them off in a soft, spacious way, with our heart kind of leading the way? So this idea of being uplifted and beauty, and how there's poetry in the suttas, which I'd like to think is the Buddha kind of pointing towards that. I'd like to read a poem. This is written by somebody, I don't know exactly when it was written, but within the last few decades, so not from the suttas. But it's about practice. And in some ways, maybe it's about the Dharma. And the author of this poem, Jane Hirschfield, is a practitioner. And the poem goes like this. It's called Tree. It is foolish to let a young redwood grow next to a house. Even in this one lifetime, you will have to choose that great calm being or this clutter of soup pots and books. Already, the first branch tips brush at the window. Softly, calmly, immensity taps at your life. So for the Buddha sat under a Bodhi tree, and Jane Hirschfield, she talks about a redwood tree. For those of you who have been to California, Jane Hirschfield, at one time I know she lived in California, I don't know if she still does. These redwood trees are majestic. They're really quite something. It's to be in a redwood forest, it's really touching. It's like being in a cathedral, this dignity and the really mighty feeling about them. And in this poem, I like to say that practice is being represented by these beautiful tree. It's kind of this something that's there, waiting. And then this poet, she says, well, it's foolish to let a young redwood grow next to a house. And a house, for the Buddha, the house represents a number of things. One can be our attachments, those things that we're tangled up with. Literally a house, but whatever it is we're tangled up with. But a house can also represent the self that we build and we want to protect and create and maybe hide behind. And so she says, it is foolish. This word foolish, in Pali, it's the same word used for foolish and for child. So it's just like just not knowing better. And the Buddha called people fools who didn't recognize that what they were doing was a source of suffering for themselves. They just didn't know better. So this poem says, even in this one lifetime, you will have to choose. The Insight Meditation Center is in Redwood City, California. Can you tell by the name of the city? There's a redwood trees there. And there's a redwood tree in front of the center. And it's a giant tree. Maybe the diameter at the base is maybe 8 feet, 6 feet, something like this, right? This is a big tree. And clearly it wasn't always that way, because the sidewalk was buckling, you know, around it, right, as the tree was growing. And the center, we felt like we need to take care of this sidewalk. We don't want people to trip on it. So we called the city to come in and work with, fix the sidewalk and do whatever needs to be done. And the city looked at this and said, oh, okay, we know what to do. And they built the sidewalk all the way around the tree. They just moved the sidewalk. They knew how powerful redwood trees are, and that this tree is just going to keep growing and impacting whatever it comes in contact with. What a great idea to think of practice, kind of like these trees, just growing, right? But as they grow, they disturb kind of what they're contacting with. Maybe in ways that are uncomfortable. Maybe in ways that are completely unexpected. But maybe there's a way in which practice, as it disrupts our attachments, or is exactly what's needed. Exactly the way the practice unfolds. So this poem continues with talking about you have to choose between this great calm being, tree, or this clutter of soup pots and books. Maybe this is a little bit autobiographical. She's a poet, and maybe she has a lot of books, but this idea of clutter. What do we fill our space with? What do we fill our time with? Clutter is the opposite of calm. Things not being cared for, maybe neglected with clutter. So this poem ends with, maybe before I go there, I'll say this, that just as it's the nature of trees to grow, it's the nature of practice to grow. Of course. And practice does two things, a number of things, but maybe here's two. Helps us to see more clearly that which we are clinging to. Maybe our soup pots and books. But it also helps us to gain the confidence and wherewithal that we can let go. Help us to see more clearly, and to help us have a mind that's ready, receptive, free of hindrances, elated and confident. So practice isn't necessarily asking us to let go of all of our soup pots and books, but to let go of our grasping to them, our clinging to them, to shift our relationship to them, and to soften and let go of all the ways that we limit and define ourselves. So the poem continues with, "Already the first branch tips brush at the window." So branch tips are what are visible above the ground, and the roots of the redwood trees are very powerful. They're moving sidewalks, and my childhood home had a redwood tree, and it got into the sewer pipes, right? It's amazing how powerful they are. But softly, calmly, immensity taps at your life. Again, this idea, immensity, kind of spaciousness, uplift. Part of what I appreciate about this poem is its simplicity. And I feel like all of us can relate to this. Our trees grow, our practice grows. Trees can be disruptive, our practice is disruptive in ways we didn't expect or anticipate. And yet we still practice. And we see the same theme carried in some of the other poems that are in the suttas. This theme of there being some difficulties, still practicing, and then finding a way to the other side of those difficulties towards freedom. For me, it's quite remarkable that the suttas, you know, thousands of years ago, they're describing something that poets today are describing. And for me, this is very meaningful, actually, to feel connected to countless people through all these years, having the same experiences. So I'd like to share some of this poems, and rather than taking the poems literally, just allowing them to maybe allow yourself to be touched or inspired by them, and view them less as directives or what one's life should be like, but more like poems that evoke ideas, sensations, emotions, maybe even a little bit of uplift in the heart. Some of these poems were, the few that I'm going to share were written by monastics, specifically women. Some of you know that the oldest literature in the world that's attributed to women are some of these poems. And these are poems by the nuns who, as part of awakening, they would have some awakening poems. Some of them describe their practice and describe the awakening. Some of them describe some of their life. But so they were monastics because, you know, at that time there were really limited choices of what a person could do with their life if they wanted to not do the usual thing. So it was either to be what your family did or to become a monastic. So in some ways these are, I like to think of this maybe a little bit of a rebellious, or maybe they had this deep calling in their hearts to ordain. But there's one thing about these poems, that they express a sense of confidence and delight. That they have this, the poems aren't like unsure of themselves, or they're not, hiding or something. There's a real forthrightness about them that I don't know, I just find really beautiful and touching. This kind of directness and clarity. So this first poem I like to read is by Chitta, is her name, and often we don't know if that was her actual name. Sometimes in the suttas people are given names that is like maybe a descriptor more than their actual name. But and she sits down to rest after a great effort, and then she becomes awakened. And in some ways this is the same story of the Buddha. We know that part of his biography, his story, right, is he practiced a lot of austerities, became, you know, incredibly emaciated, and but then he realized, oh, this isn't right, and sat down under a tree, rested, we might say, and became awakened. He didn't rest necessarily under the tree, but, you know, it was going a different direction. So here is this poem from Chitta. I climb the mountain, leaning on a cane, though I'm skinny, sick, and very feeble. Having laid down my outer robe and overturned my bowl, propping myself against a rock, the mass of darkness shattered. So she has these difficulties. She's sick and feeble, and she's climbing this mountain. And I appreciate very much, she writes, leaning on a cane. I love this. She has something to, she realizes, you know, I could use a little support. And she uses some support to help her. We all can use some support, whether it's literally a cane or not. And yet she continues to climb this mountain, and she had some great effort after this, and she sits down and rests, and maybe, we don't know, in my mind, I sometimes imagine that after she sits and she's at the top of the mountain, that maybe there's a nice view, a big view, and the heart is uplifted. And the mass of darkness is shattered. Darkness here refers to like not being able to see, so ignorance. Instead, there was this clear seeing. And another poet, a contemporary poet, having read the Pali, I read you the English, but of the Pali, Matty Winegast, when he read the Pali, he wrote a poem based on this story. It goes like this. Somehow I kept climbing, though tired, hungry, and weak, old too. At the top of the mountain, I spread my outer robe on a rock to dry, set down my staff and bowl, took a deep breath, and looked around. It was windy up there. As I was leaning back against a large gray rock, the darkness that I had carried up and down a million mountains slipped off my shoulders and swept away on the wind. Slipped off the shoulders. Again, this idea of difficulties and yet finding a way to the other side. Here's another one by this nun. Her name is Sama. In this poem, there's the expression I went forth. To go forth is to ordain. In the 25 years since I went forth, I don't know that I ever found serenity in my mind. right, this is somebody thousands of years ago talking about what sometimes feels like my own mind. I love this. I had failed to find peace of heart or any control over my mind when I remembered the victor's instructions. I was struck with a sense of urgency, though subject to so many painful things. I have, through my love of diligence, reached the ending of craving and fulfilled the Buddha's instructions. This is the seventh day since my craving dried up. So for her, kind of the freedom is just craving drying up. Even though she felt like 25 years of practicing. So sometimes it feels like that, whether it's 25 minutes, 25 years. But she wasn't able to find ease, but she was able to hang in there and continue practicing. So again, here's a contemporary poet inspired by the Pali of that poem, and he writes a different poem. He writes, "After 25 years on the path, I'd experienced almost everything except peace. When I was young, my mother told me that I would find true happiness only in marriage. Remembering her words all those years later, something in me began to tremble. I gave myself to the trembling, and it showed me all the pain this little heart had ever known, and how countless lives of searching had brought me at last to the present moment, which I happily married." Can you imagine? We've been living together ever since without a single argument. I love this kind of, you know, this playfulness here and, you know, kind of like twisting things and the way that, you know, maybe we're finding our own way with this practice, our own way with this path, even though it's sometimes difficult and uncomfortable. So here's another poem. It's by the nun Padachara. For those of you who have been to the... I'm sorry, I'm trying to make this less noisy, but maybe I'm making it worse. For those of you who have been to the Insight Retreat Center in California, you know that the biggest meditation hall, of course, is the Buddha. Not so different than this one, actually. The other meditation hall, a little bit smaller one, has Padachara. And she was one of the premier, if not the premier, teacher. She was a nun who taught other nuns. And so there was the statue of Padachara that's there at the Insight Retreat Center was a gift from a number of students who had practiced together and done some training together, and we felt like we wanted to offer something as an appreciation for the training we had received and something that would support others. So an individual took this on primarily, but it was a group of us that were helping. Commissioned an artist to do a statue of Padachara. And it was a long process and took quite a long time. But, you know, we do now have a statue of Padachara in the meditation hall. But one thing that touches me about this little story is the artist, she was touched about this group of people coming together and wanting to honor the women in early Buddhism in this way, the early teachers. So she started to make replicas, and then this other big seller of Dharma goods now sells statues of Padacharya. So, and then this other teacher that in another tradition that I happened to be talking to in another setting was talking about, oh, I discovered that there's now these statues of Padacharya, and she had purchased one, and she was talking about how wonderful it was and meaningful it was to her. So just this way that this impulse to be generous and maybe some honor and respect and love often can spread out in ways that we don't even anticipate. Something that was born out of some of this uplift of the heart. So Padacharya, her poem. Maybe I'll say, I also know for those of you who have been here for 3 months that Carol did some poems at that also. And I think she did this poem too. I don't know all the poems that she did, but this translation may be different. In fact, I know this translation is different. Okay, Padacharya. Plowing fields with plows, sowing seeds in the ground, caring for children and family, people gain wealth. Why is it that I, thorough in virtuous conduct, doing the Buddha's instructions, not lazy or proud, have not attained release? I'll just insert a little commentary here. She's saying other people are seeing benefits from what they're doing, the farmers and the family people. I'm a practitioner and I haven't seen the benefit. You know, why not? I watched the water, the foot washing water, flow from high ground to low. With this, the mind concentrated like a thoroughbred horse. Taking an oil lamp, I entered my hut. Looking over the bed, I sat down on the bed. Taking a needle, I pulled out the wick. As the flame went out, the mind was freed. So again, pointing to some difficulties. And also something I'd like to highlight here is like these awakening moments. They're all they are not expected. And I would say almost by definition, not almost, by definition, these will happen when they're not expected, right? If we're trying, and at any moment now, right? If that's not when it's going to happen. It's when there's some ready, receptive, free of the hindrances, elated and confident. The qualities of a mind that's ready for awakening. And so this, in this poem is also this watching the water from high to low. We might say that, well, that's just the natural way of things. Coarse water goes from the high ground to the low ground. But there's a way in which maybe there's this aligning with reality, aligning with what is, without interfering or wishing that it were otherwise, but just, she uses the word concentrated, so collecting around this idea. And then maybe I'll end with my favorite poem, which is this one that's written by Maddie Weingast. Goes like this. While walking along the river after a long day meditating on Vulture Peak, I watched an elephant splashing its way out of the water and up the bank. Hello, my friend. a person waiting there said, scratching the elephant behind its ear, "Did you have a good bath?" The elephant stretched out its leg. The person climbed up, and the two rode off like that, together. Seeing what had once been so wild, now a friend and companion to this good person, I took a seat under the nearest tree and reached out a gentle hand to my own mind. Truly, I thought, this is why I came to the woods. I took a seat under the nearest tree and reached out a gentle hand to my own mind. Truly, I thought, this is why I came to this retreat. Reaching out a gentle hand to our own mind. So might there be a way in which we can allow some of the beauty or this uplift of the heart or Dharma beauty, poetry, to be a support for practice, in addition to the lists and the numbers and the instructions? But is there a way in which we can meld these together and not neglect some of the inspiring, uplifting aspects? And may we all contribute a verse to the poem of this human race, human life. And may this verse be for the benefit of all beings everywhere. Thank you. Let's just
thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.